Hello, and welcome to episode number 9 of The Music Plays the Band. I'm your host, Rob Koritz of the Dark Star Orchestra. Thanks for joining me today. I hope you all are safe and well. My last release day was great. I brought out 2 episodes on the same day with Jeff Comenti and Larry Campbell and Teresa Williams. Your response was great, and I really appreciate you all tuning in. I'm excited to follow it up today with one of my favorite drummers, my friend John Molo. I got turned on to Molo's playing back in the Bruce Hornsby days, and I've always admired his feel for the music and just how he puts so much soul into it. We're going to have to change the name of our cover band segment for the day to There is a Grateful Dead Cover Band in Every Country, as we speak with Shuhei, the keyboardist for the Warlocks of Tokyo from, you guessed it, Tokyo, Japan. Before we get started, I'd like to ask you to check out our Patreon site and consider a monthly subscription for access to bonus content, including unedited interviews and outtakes. And actually, this week I'm going to have a great video version, unedited, of my interview with Shuhei, with the interpreter and all. So it's kind of cool. There's also expanded video versions of the Black Music Moment and Sarno Music Solutions Breakdown. I bring you videos from home and very soon from on the road. Community gatherings. We just had our first one a couple weeks ago, and it was great to get together with some of the patrons and learn more about what they'd like to hear on the podcast. There's also some cool swag and other ways to further engage with me and support the podcast. Check it out at www.patreon.com/themusicplays, and I'm happy to let you know there's also a second way to help out now with a one-time contribution at paypal.me/themusicplays. Black Music Moment is brought to you by The Clean Store, brandingandapparel.com for all your branding and apparel needs. Technology-driven solutions and concierge service for managing programs of all sizes. The Black Music Moment is our attempt at chronicling the profound influence of black music and musicians on the Grateful Dead. Today we honor the national treasure, Harry Belafonte. Harry Belafonte was born to Jamaican parents in Harlem in 1927. From the age of 5 to 13 years old, he lived in Jamaica with one of his grandmothers. He returned to New York City to finish high school and first began to study acting with his friend Sidney Poitier. He became successful very quickly and even won a Tony Award in 1953. He started his music career actually as a way to pay for his acting classes. He began performing professionally, and his first gig took place at the Village Vanguard, where, get this, I mean, this guy was always surrounded by greatness. His backing band for his very first gig included Charlie Parker, Max Roach, and Miles Davis. He touched on all styles of music, starting as a pop singer, moving on to folk music, and eventually turning on the entire world to the rhythms and joy of calypso, the music of Trinidad. His 1956 album, Calypso, sold over 1 million copies in its first year and spent 31 weeks at number 1 on the U.S. charts. Back in the 50s, these numbers are just unheard of. He released many other Calypso albums, but also recorded folk, blues, gospel, and show tunes as well. He continued to record and act, but became very involved in both humanitarian causes and political activism in the 50s and 60s, and was a close confidant of Martin Luther King Jr. He has never stopped advocating for causes, whether it be politics, civil rights, or famine. He actually he was one of the organizers of USA for Africa to record We Are the World back in the 80s for famine relief. He has appeared in over 3 dozen movies, countless TV shows, and released 38 albums. He has won Tony Awards, Emmys, a Kennedy Center Honor, and the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. In 1981, Bob Weir introduced the song Man Smart, Woman Smarter into the mix of the Grateful Dead's playlist. Now, Belafonte had popularized this song on the album Calypso, but it was actually written and originally recorded by a Trinidadian named Norman Spann in 1936. Another song popularized by Belafonte, Matilda, made a handful of appearances in 1994 and 95. You know, I could go on and on about this man and his life. I've always enjoyed him. My parents had the Harry Belafonte's Greatest Hits album when I was a kid, and I would listen to it constantly and just loved it. And what's amazing is he is still active today at 94 years of age, still after doing his thing. So here is Harry Belafonte in his version of Man Smart, Women Smarter.
I say, let us put man and a woman together to find out which one is smarter. Some say men, but I say no. The women got the men, they should know, and not me. But the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the woman is smarter. That's right, the
any woman is smarter. That's right. That's right. Ever since the world began, woman was always teaching man. You listen to my bit attentively. I'm going to tell you how she smarter than me cannot be. But the they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. Samson was the strongest man long ago. No one could have beat him, as we all know, until he clashed with Delilah on top of the bed. She told him all the strength was in the hair of his head, and not me. But the people, they say that the men are leading the women astray. But I say that the women of today smarter than the man in every way. That's right. The woman is smarter. That's right. The woman is smarter. That's right. The woman is smarter. That's right. That's right.
The Sarno Music Solutions Breakdown with Brad Sarno is brought to you by Sarno Music Solutions, producing the finest musical instrument gear designed and hand-built right here in St. Louis, Missouri since 2003. And Blue Jade Audio Mastering, St. Louis's primary audio mastering service since 1999. So today Brad and I are going to get started on a series of conversations about the live sound of the Dead and the men responsible for it. So let's just jump right in. Here we go. Okay, I'm back again today with Brad Sarno, my friend. How are you doing?
Doing well, Rob.
Glad to have you along, as always. We've spent so much time talking about the musicians and their instruments and their gear and the way they get their tones, but we haven't really talked about when that comes out to the fans and where they hear it. So I kind of wanted to talk about some of the sound reinforcement and the sound guys and all of that. And I figure there's no better place to start than Bear, Owsley Stanley.
Absolutely.
He came on way early. I mean, he was there right from in the 60s at the Acid Test, if I'm not mistaken.
He was kind of the facilitator of what happened, really.
And from what I read, he was around and doing other stuff, and he said, I can help with the sound, and took over and started putting together all these different parts of different PAs. And essentially, as time went on, they built the Wall of Sound, which was something no one had ever seen. I mean, the Grateful Dead, let's be honest, when it comes to sound quality and live audio, they were innovators. They were ahead of their time on everything, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Revolutionary. They were the guinea pigs of technologists that were testing stuff. They were the testing ground for all kinds of stuff. Their demands and the philosophy they adopted from Bear was just, you know, it's never good enough. Just go for the best. You know, the best fidelity, the music's so important. It has to sound amazing.
And they always would put their money back into their sound system.
Yeah, apparently.
They would reinvest whatever, you know, when they made profits, they didn't just take it. They would try and go and make themselves better in that. So the Wall of Sound, and I know it wasn't just Bear. I know Healy was part of that because he was an assistant back then. And the guys from Alembic and Rick Turner and the crew had to build the damn thing. For those of you out there that know what the Wall of Sound is, it's just a massive, massive, it's a massive line array, really, isn't it?
It really is. It's the birth of the line array, to the best of our knowledge. And it's really unique. It corresponds to the philosophy of the Grateful Dead in a big way, where they really put the control of the mix and the dynamics in the hands of the artists on stage. They each guy had his own massive tower of speakers, and they had their own control. That stuff was not controlled by a sound person out front. The only thing out front that was controlled by the house was the vocals. But the instruments were in the hands of each guy, and with beautiful Macintosh amps and JBL speakers, huge, tall towers.
So each tower was for a different player, right?
Yeah, each instrument had its own discrete PA system, basically.
That's crazy.
Yeah. The people who I'm a little too young to have witnessed it in person, but the people I know that did said, there's just nothing like that sound. There's just nothing like that clarity and that organic purity.
And Phil's thing took it even a step further than just having his own tower, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he had a guitar pickup system where each string had its own pickup and output, and each string was sent to its own tower, which in each tower, they were spread across the stage. So it was a massive, kind of insane bass rig up there.
Were the towers stacked on each side of the stage for both of them? Did Jerry have a tower on each side of center so that the image going out to the crowd was balanced?
I believe Jerry just had his tower that was behind him.
Wow.
And the same went for Bob.
That has to be so loud.
You know, I understand that it wasn't that brutally loud. It just, the line array factor gave it very focused imaging, and the height of the tower helped cover a big crowd and a long distance. But it was probably pretty loud on stage because these speakers were behind the artists.
I don't know if I could do that. It's thinking about that, you know, you or me or anybody who's played live has never really played with the speakers behind us. The PA is always in front of us, and right. We have a monitor system and we have in-ears now, or just our stage amps. I can't imagine having the entire sound system behind me.
Yeah. I wonder what that was like. But again, you know, there's something about that philosophy they were going with, that whole Bear philosophy of extreme fidelity, quality of audio. And when things are that clean and well-designed and well-placed, you don't really have to be brutally loud to be heard. And so I imagine it wasn't quite the brutal, loud shitstorm on stage that you might imagine.
All right, my friend. Well, thank you very much. You take care, and we will talk to you very soon.
All right. Good talking to you, Rob. Take care.
All right. Thank you. That's Brad Sarno, folks. All right. We're going to pick that conversation up right where we left off next week, because there's definitely more to talk about when it comes to the wall of sound and a lot of the innovations that the Grateful Dead made in the world of sound. Moving on to our next segment, today's edition of There Is a Grateful Dead Cover Band in Every Town is brought to you by the Authenticity Academy, offering you online courses and private coaching. If you're feeling stuck or confused about the direction your life is going in, or you've lost touch with your authentic self, the Authenticity Academy is here to help. www.authenticity.coach. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, we're going to have to change the name of this segment just for this week to There Is a Grateful Dead Cover Band in Every Country, as we head to Japan to speak with Shuhei, the keyboardist for the Warlocks of Tokyo. It was really great to talk to someone from another culture and really hear about the universal appeal of the Grateful Dead. Okay, so this week on the There's a Grateful Dead Cover Band in Every Town segment, we're going to give it a little bit of an international flavor, and there's a Grateful Dead cover band in every country. And I'm very happy to welcome from the Warlocks of Tokyo in Japan, Shuhei, and our interpreter, Brad Lefton. Thank you both for being here. Shuhei, thank you so much.
Yeah, me too. Thank you very much.
It's really wonderful to have you here. The Warlocks of Tokyo is the band. Can you tell me a little bit about how and when the band got started?
まず私は初期のメンバーではありません。
So the group itself has been performing for about 30 years.
Wow.
I'm not an original member of the group, but they have been together for about 30 years. And as I understand it, they began as a Grateful Dead cover band.
Amazing. 30 years in Japan. So you told me you were 38 and you're the youngest member. You play the keyboards. How long have you been in the band?
Shuhei-san wa sono bando ni haitta no wa nan nen desu ka?
10 nen gurai play shimasu.
10 nen. About 10 years.
All right.
Yeah, so about 10 years. So 2012 or 11. Or maybe.
The instrumentation you all use is, do you have two drummers?
Yes, two drummers.
Drummers. And right now you're not really able to perform too much, I assume, because of the pandemic. When
when there's no pandemic and it's just a regular time, how often do the Warlocks of Tokyo go out and perform?
I would say probably 2 to 3. We probably have 2 to 3 gigs in a normal month when there's not a pandemic.
And are they all in Tokyo?
Tokyo のみですか? Tokyo 以外のところでもライブやってますか?
はい。東京もやりますし、その他の郊外、
田舎のところとか。 So we, of course, we perform a lot in Tokyo, but we're not limited to Tokyo. We go all over Japan. We've performed in Hokkaido, the island to the north of the main island. We've performed in Aomori, which is in the very north of the main island. We've performed in Miyazaki, which is on the southern island of Kyushu. So we've performed all over Japan.
And there's Grateful Dead fans everywhere you go.
Dead のファンは全国にいるんですか?
そうです。全国に行って、その日本中の Dead ファンがなんかイベントを企画して、Warlocks を呼んでくれます。
Yeah, they're all over Japan, and we get called to perform all over Japan by the Grateful Dead fans that are all over the place.
How did you personally, I guess, because the band started before you, but how did you learn about the Grateful Dead's music? How did you come to learn it and come to know about it?
High school, 高校生の時ですね。はい、私は東京から。
I'm from an area close to Tokyo, but not in Tokyo, called Utsunomiya. That's where I was born and grew up. And I probably have been a fan of the Grateful Dead since high school. And there was a shop called, I think you understood.
Jack Straw.
It's
the name of a Grateful Dead song.
Oh, the name of a Grateful Dead song. Yeah. Yeah. It was the name of a store.
Yeah.
In, store, yes. Clothes shop.
Fashion, clothes shop.
Fashion shop.
In Utsunomiya.
In Utsunomiya.
Yeah.
So, very local place.
Yeah. Utsunomiya is a very small town. But they had a clothes fashion shop that sold Oregon tie-dyes and other clothes.
Yeah, kind of hempware.
Hempware.
Hempware, yeah. Tie-dye batiks.
So as a high schooler, I would shop there, and that's how it all started.
What was it about this music that appealed to you? What grabbed you and made you love this music?
So, Grateful Dead の音楽に何を気に入りましたか？最初は。
最初は全然わからなかった。どこがいいの？
I think that I didn't understand the lyrics. In the beginning, I didn't know what they were singing about. But the more I listened, I was just impressed by their ability to improv. And that's what really turned me on at first.
That's something I was going to ask later, but I'm going to go there now. I know that Shuhei speaks a little bit of English, but none of the other band members do. So how are they able to learn the lyrics, and are they able to comprehend what their meanings are and what those songs are talking about?
正直、すべて完璧に歌詞を理解するのは。
So we don't have a perfect understanding of the lyrics, but what we do is we just, as best we can, we try to study the meaning of the lyrics. You know, either we'll look up the words in a dictionary ourselves, or we'll ask an English-speaking friend or a foreigner to tell us what this means. And when we sing the songs, we sing them in Japanese, so we translate the songs into Japanese as best we can, as with the resources that we have to understand the lyrics. We translate them into Japanese, and we perform in Japanese.
You perform all the songs in Japanese, none in English?
全曲は日本語で歌ってるんですか？
全部ではないです。主にジェリーソング は日本語でやってますね。で、ボビーソングはイングリッシュでやってます。
So, we sing Jerry's songs, we sing in Japanese, but Bobby's songs we do in English.
Interesting. Is there a reason behind that?
なぜでしょうか?
いや、なんだろう。ジェリーパートはバンドのリーダーなんですけど、
Our band's leader, the Warlocks leader, he sings, he's responsible for the Jerry songs. So he's our Jerry guy. Right. And he speaks a little English. And in the 1980s, he actually traveled to America and went to some Grateful Dead concerts. And so he has a little understanding. So he is one of his responsibilities within the band is he's in charge of all Jerry stuff.
When you all play the music, do you, how can I say this? How do you all interpret the music? Do you try and play it true to its original form? Or do you put your own spin on it? Or do you have a mindset when you go in to start playing this music?
そうね。雰囲気は。
So we try to be respectful to the mood of each piece. But, you know, when it comes to the lyrics or some specific sounds, we take a lot of liberties ourselves, but we try to be true, you know, to the overall mood of the piece.
That's beautiful. Wow. Shuhei, are you familiar with all of the different Grateful Dead keyboard players? Keith, Brandt, Pigpen, all of that?
Oh.
Do you have a favorite?
My number one is Keith Garcia.
Is Keith?
Yeah.
Why?
Keith, 音のチョイスが素晴らしいですね。
He's feel that there's just a great sensitivity to the sounds that he produces. I really like the harmony and the sensitivity that he evoked.
Tell me a little bit about the Deadhead community in Tokyo or all in Japan, since you travel a lot. You have a strong following. Is there a big Grateful Dead following? I know part of this because we played Fuji Rocks in 2011, and I was amazed at how many people in the crowd, whether they knew English or not, they were all singing along. They all knew the words to the Grateful Dead music in Japan. Do you see a lot of the same people at every show? Do you have like a strong community that follows you to listen to the Grateful Dead music?
東京から一緒に来る人もいますし、その現地のファンもいます。
So both. We have people who follow us from Tokyo to our performances in Kyushu, the southern island of Kyushu, or all the way to the northern island of Hokkaido or wherever we go. But we also have local fans in any city that we play.
And do they run the whole age group from old to young, all ages come out to hear you?
どんな年齢ですか? I would say we have a lot of old deadheads, in their 60s, 70s. I would say that would be the most of the fans, but we also have young fans in their 30s.
And you're over where you are. You're the reason you have those young fans. You're the one turning them on to the Grateful Dead, which is so beautiful. What is it about this music and this community, do you think, that attracts people in Japan especially, but attracts people from such a different culture than where this music originates? What is it about it that brings everybody together, in your opinion?
やっぱり音楽の素晴らしさと、なんだろう、グレートフルデッドの
I have to think that even though the American culture and the Japanese culture are different, that the end result of the feeling that the fans get in America or Japan from the music is similar. It inspires the listener in a similar way. So I think that what the Japanese fans ultimately get from the music, or what they enjoy about the music, the way it makes them feel, is probably similar to the effect that it has on listeners in America or anywhere else.
In the American community, anyway, I can equate it to. Part of it is that, and then there's also this part that once the music brings these people together, they have a community of like-minded people that can bond and spend time together and be a community. Does that happen there as well, or is it just about the music?
それはやっぱり日本のシーンはすごくアメリカに比べてすごく小さい。
I think yes, I think it's the same in Japan, although on a smaller scale. I think that probably the number of people, you know, who gather to do that is probably the smaller group. But even though it's a smaller group, they have that same dynamic of enjoying being together with other people who enjoy the music.
And that's to me, that's the beauty of the Grateful Dead. The fact that this music cultivates a community and brings people together. And I love that you all over there are spreading the word for the Grateful Dead and keeping the spirit alive and turning new fans onto it as well. Thank you so much for being with us. It's late at night here in St. Louis, and it's the middle of your day there. And I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us and let the people over here in my audience know about what y'all are doing over there with the Grateful Dead. Everybody's so happy that this music is all over the world, and I want to thank you very much for being here.
遅い時間、まあ、日本は昼間か。こっちは遅い時間。
ありがとうございます。
でもまあ、お忙しいところで時間を作って、いただいてありがとうございました。
とんでもないです。こちらこそ、このような機会をいただいて。
Excellent. That is Shuhei from the Warlocks of Tokyo, and I'd like to thank Brad Lefton for doing a great job interpreting for me. Definitely made this go much smoother. So thank you again very much.
ありがとうございました。
はい、ありがとうございます。Thank you very much.
So cool to talk to him and hear how this music that we love so much really transcends cultural and language barriers all over the world. There's a full video version of this interview available along with much, much more when you purchase a subscription at www.patreon.com/themusicplays. We have a few different levels to choose from, and this interview is available at all of them. If you'd like to support the podcast with a one-time contribution, please visit paypal.me/themusicplays. Our featured conversation is brought to you by Grateful Sweats. On Shakedown or online, Grateful Sweats is your first stop for subtle dead designs. Check them out at etsy.com/shop/gratefulsweats and see for yourself. Designs that only other heads will get. When you're wearing the State of Tennessee with Jed in it and someone says, "Nice shirt," you know they're on the bus. And a subtle dead cap makes its point. No one else does sweats like Grateful Sweats. Hoodies, sweatpants, joggers, tees, and much more. And right now, we're happy to offer a special discount to our listeners. Get $10 off when you enter the coupon code THEMUSICPLAYS. That is $10 off any purchase through April 7th, so visit etsy.com/shop/gratefulsweats today. So today I'm talking with drummer John Molo. John's been a part of the Grateful Dead family since opening for the Dead with Bruce Hornsby in the Range back in the 80s. He was a part of the 90s offshoot The Other Ones, and he became a constant in Phil and Friends starting in 1999. Over the years, he's also toured with John Fogerty, Chris Robinson, my bandmate Rob Baracco, David Nelson, and is a longtime member of the band Moon Alice. You know, it's always fun to talk to a drummer, but especially as one as engaging as John. So sit back and relax, or continue that walk, or workout, or whatever you're doing, and enjoy our conversation.
Okay, so I am here today with my friend John Molo. How are you, my friend?
Hey, I'm doing great. I'm here in Southern California, and it's great to be here with you.
I appreciate you taking the time. What have you been doing with yourself? We haven't really been able to go out on the road. So how have you been staying sane during this pandemic?
Well, you know, I'm a bit of a collector instrument wise. So I started doing a lot of work on these drum sets that I have. I probably have like 10 kits and a bunch of snares. So I did that. And then I finished that, and we're still in the middle of it. So I made a point to really stay in physical and mental shape so that when it did come back, I was not totally scuffling. I did a rehearsal the other day with our friend Roger McNamee, Moon Alice, the Tea Sisters, Chambers Brothers. And I was feeling it after that third rehearsal, for sure.
I know. When we talked on the phone the other day, I was getting off the phone to go pick up my kids. And you said you were getting off the phone to go work on your double strokes. So yeah. have you been practicing a bunch? Have you been able to do that?
Yeah, I've been working on some stuff that, you know, I pick out stuff that I can work on for like 3 or 4 years. So, yeah, the double strokes, some of the rudiments, playing an odd time, 7 and 9. Jason Crosby's been helping me with some Brubeck in 9. It's always a challenge. So I just try to keep it mentally fresh and stay in shape. I also work on some of the Caribbean stuff, whether it be reggae or like sort of the Cuban style of music. I call it Caribbean, clave, son clave, rumba clave. I still work on that stuff. So I'm just trying to stay in shape. So when it does come back, I'm not sucking.
Are you playing every day?
Just about. I have so many drum kits, like I said, that it's hard to walk by them without taking like 10 minutes to get intimate with the drum kit.
Good for you. Good for you. And that's awesome. I wish I had a little bit more time to practice, but you know, we're starting to get some gigs and people are starting to play. There's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. So that's a good thing, right?
Oh man. I can hardly wait to hear you guys. You're always so nice to me when I show up as a fan and a listener. And then every once in a while, you actually ask me to sit in.
Oh, it's so much fun, man. It's so fun. Much fun. You grew up in the DC area. I know that. Can you tell me a little bit, tell us a little bit about your musical upbringing and background, how you really got started?
Yeah, sure. There was always a lot of music in our house. My mom listened to sort of mainstream pop, and my dad was more of a Brandenburg Concerto Bach guy. So we always had some music going on. And then my sisters, one played accordion, the other played piano. They were taking lessons, and I thought it was pretty cool. I knew I didn't want to play piano or accordion because I had been up at Andrews Air Force Base, and there was a jazz trio up there. And I walked up to the drum kit, and the mounted tom was probably taller than I was. And the guy behind the drum kit said, "Would you like to play drums?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'm ready right now. If you would move over, I'd get behind the kit and play." And I had never played a note in my life. So it was just sort of a thing that I wanted to do. I was very fortunate to be in D.C. And I'll cite the best thing about being a young musician in D.C. because you have the Army Band, the Navy Band, the Air Force Band, the Marine Band. There's a plane going overhead.
No worries.
Here in the West Valley. Because you have all those great service bands, there's always some really smoking hot drummers to take lessons from. And back in the early 70s, of course, we were in the midst of a draft situation. But if you could get in one of the bands, you'd do 6 weeks of boot camp and then just go around playing ceremonial events. Hence, for a lot of us, we see Steve Gadd in a military outfit.
Right.
I heard Steve when I was a junior in high school with the Army Field Band. So there was always a lot of ceremonial music around D.C. You could always get some lessons. And, you know, a lot of diversity down there on the left-hand side. You had WHUR out of Howard. You had the Sunday morning Bluegrass Gospel Hour. And it was a good musical place to grow up, for sure.
You're of the age, and I don't know if this – you're of the age when – I guess you're probably early teens maybe – when the Beatles hit Ed Sullivan Show. Do you remember that? Was that a moment for you?
Absolutely. I was in fifth grade, St. Francis Xavier on Pennsylvania Avenue in Southeast DC, over by where O'Teal and Kofi grew up. And yeah, that was a big event. You know, I saw them perform on TV and it was unbelievable to me how good they were. And like how I didn't realize about intonation and stuff like that, of course. But then I showed up the next day of school, whatever it was, one of the kids had seen the Beatles in D.C. at the D.C. Armory, I believe.
Wow.
And he was of the same mindset as I was. It was just incredible. So, yeah, I got to see them. There were some other really cool records like Dave Clark Five. If you listen to them, boy, that sounds a lot like Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band with the rock sax and Mike Smith singing vocals. So, yeah, I really got into that British invasion thing, whatever it was. But even before that, just even folk music, like, you know, stuff you'd hear on the radio, I liked all of it, whether it was jazz or folk or pop. I was just into music for sure. So
how old were you when you started playing drums?
I was in seventh grade, so I was about 12. Right. And I wasn't very good. Jones, that's Elvin Jones. it's quiet. I just knew I wanted to play drums, and I knew I wanted to play some music, and I liked these bands, and there were some other bands around Northern Virginia, the DC area, that were pretty good. The Organic Cavemen, the Yorkshires. It was supposed to be Yorkshires, but they called it the Yorkshires. A number of bands that could, like, you know, play two or three sets and be pretty good. So that's kind of what I wanted to do. I didn't really know how I was going to monetize it. And then I found out about this band, Dino, Desi, and Billy, that was using, they were using the best session players in Los Angeles. And I thought, what's a session player? And then the Monkees came out, and people were like, hey, they're not really playing their instruments. And I went, well, who is, and how can I get that gig?
Right.
I was musically curious. And it's interesting. Some people say, oh, the Monkees, it was plastic or fake or whatever. And I was like, yeah, but those records are pretty good. That's Hal Blaine, I think.
And look who wrote those songs. I mean, you're looking at Carole King and Neil Diamond and people like that.
Neil Diamond, Voice and Heart. There's some great ones. I'm a Believer. It's just, you know, it's been a hit probably
that's real
two or
stuff.
Three times.
So, you know, at that point or during that, those high school days, you know, you want to take this a little further and you go study music in Miami. And man, yep. I did a little reason. You were there with some heavy hitters, man. Pat Metheny, Hiram Bullock, Steve Morris, Hornsby, Danny Gottlieb. My God, you all are in school together.
Yeah. And I just thought, like, well, here we go. This is the real world here. There was the guitar players down there were incredible. Stan Simoli was one of the teachers, but there was Hiram Bullock. Metheny swerved into the scene for a little while. So it was just kind of a standard of like, okay, I'd like to be in that first band, but Danny Gottlieb's there. Yeah. So I got to really work hard to get there. Danny, sweet guy. Great sound and a good reader too. So you kind of had to have the package deal to succeed at Miami.
That's crazy that all of them are in the same place at the same time.
Yeah. At that time, it just sort of hit and people go, wow, were you into the Miami music scene? And I said, I think we started our own kind of thing there. It's just kind of developed. And even Bruce had only been playing a little while. He was really into high school basketball and probably would have been a mid-level Division I basketball player, but his junior year of high school, I think he went, you know, I want to play piano. So
probably a good career choice.
Longevity.
Yeah, exactly. Is that how, when you were at Miami, is that when you first hear the Grateful Dead? Do you remember?
Well, we'll go back to that. Sure. I was like a sophomore in high school. I'd heard of the band. The name was so great. And I'll try to not ramble too much with this. I was in a band, one of those bands called the Yorkshires. I got asked to play drums in that when one of their drummers went off to college. And they pull out that Grateful Dead album, the one with all the tubas on it. And I think I mentioned the other day, we learned that song, Hey,
Golden Road.
The party every day.
Yeah, the Golden Road.
Thank you. But I thought it was Nirvana every day. But we didn't have the lyric sheet, so we learned it. And I thought, oh, that's a pretty cool jam. And really didn't sort of swerve back into the Dead until American University, which some of your fans will know, 72 or 73, a free show that we just walked down the hill to what now is an intramural field. And I'm guessing by today's standard, there may be 3,000 to 4,000 people there. And I thought the band was cool, but I thought the audience was the most fantastic thing that I've ever seen. Because for a lot of us, you know, the Dead's conceptually sometimes exceeded their chops, their playing ability. They were so far into Coltrane and, you know, this adventurous freestyle playing. So they kind of lost me, but the audience like stayed right with it the whole time. They were super patient. And I said to myself, self, someday maybe you'll find this audience and they'll find you and you'll be able to play for them. Wow. And sure enough, man, all of a sudden I'm working with Bruce Hornsby at the University of Miami and he goes, yeah, let's touch on this Grateful Dead jam called the Big Railroad Blues. So I hadn't played Big Railroad Blues. I didn't know what Big Railroad Blues was. So Bobby Hornsby, who's on bass, a year or two older than Bruce, goes, just play rock, man. Play like a Chuck Berry thing or something. And he goes, I got this. And we started into and Bobby Hornsby, he's doing Phil Lesh, which I had never even considered. And here I'm getting a lesson from Bobby Hornsby on how to play with Phil Lesh, and I didn't even know it. Right. And then I noticed the crowd response to Big Railroad Blues was rather substantial. It's like all the people who were Deadheads turned purple and applauded for Big Railroad Blues. My awareness started to grow more and more from that initial salvo of sophomore year in high school. When I saw him at AU, I remember a couple girls came up and said, "Do you guys have a bottle opener?" And my friend Marty McGoldrick from McLean High School said, "No, but I can open it." And I think he opened it with his teeth or his belt buckle. And these girls just thought it was so cute and laughed. And I thought, man, this is where I belong. These people are super nice. So that's kind of my introduction to the Dead. With it, one thing is that Bruce emphasized the reason that they were successful is because of their great songwriting.
Right.
And that stayed with me.
And Bruce, I mean, when you started playing with Bruce and Bobby, they're playing quite a few Grateful Dead songs at that point. I mean, I remember hearing there's a tape out there of some playing in the band they did. I assume that's you on drums as well.
That might be the earlier band out of Charlottesville, Virginia.
That might be.
Long before Dave Matthews ever got there.
Right.
They had more of a Dead cover band that Bruce was in. But most of our stuff was like, you know, Sugar Mag or Going Down the Road, Big Railroad Blues, kind of the easier side before we got into the more advanced stuff.
And is that the point where you really start to absorb what the, not just the crowd, now you're really talking about the music. Is that when you start to absorb what the music is about coming out of the head?
Yeah. When Brent started to have some issues, God rest his soul, they called Bruce. And I remember we were in Bruce Hornsby in the Range and we were doing pretty well. We were doing really well, selling millions of records. And I remember Bruce said, "Yeah, they want me to come in and fill in." And I was like, "Yeah, man, that's cool. We'll expand our audience and you'll do really well with that. They'll like you and you like them. And you know a lot of the songs." One of the guys in the band was not so keen on it.
Right.
But Bruce decided to do it. And I would go in the back lounge of the bus with Bruce. And he was such a hard worker and so diligent. He'd have his songbook out and he'd be going through these songs. So all of a sudden I started hearing songs like Estimated Profit, which I had never heard before, or Jack Straw. Hey, here's to you, Bobby. Or as I called it originally, The Bride of Cucamonga. The stuff that I kind of knew. And I went, oh man, this has really got some stuff to it. This is great. That's when I really started to get into the material rather than just, you know, the feel of it. I started to actually get into what they were doing. Favorite period, probably 72 to 74. Just a quick story about playing with Bobby and Phil. They asked me to play with them and I said, "I'll do my best." I said, "I just want to tell you that I cannot play like Kreutzmann or Mickey." And in a beautiful gesture, Phil and Bobby said to me, "John, we're hiring for you. We want you to play like you. You know how the songs go. We don't expect you to sound like anybody else but you." And from the get, it was like, wow, they're giving me permission to be myself. And that was a beautiful thing. I mean, you know, between us as drummers, I'm trying to play Shakedown Street the way Jeff Beccaro from Toto would play. It just doesn't sound like that.
Right.
So they provided me a great opportunity. And, you know, I still learn something about the lyrics of the songs every now and then. Sometimes I've played them a lot. And I didn't realize what, that song about Altamont. I didn't realize it was about Altamont. I was like, whoa, that's really heavy.
Oh,
this darkness has got to end.
Yeah. New speed.
One way or another.
New speed.
Yeah. I didn't get that. I drive by that place all the time.
I want to jump around a little bit since you went there and you started talking about, so that's the other ones, right? Like 97, 98, when you're doing that, when you really first start playing with them.
Yeah.
Is that, we're going to jump around. I'm going to move up to that because I wanted to ask you, when you join the other ones, that's you and Mickey. I saw a bunch of those shows. Is that your first time double drumming per se, working with another drum set player?
Yeah, pretty much.
What's that like?
Full time. How was that?
How's it changed your approach, your mindset? What's it like for you when all of a sudden you've gone from, you know, playing super popular music as one drummer and always working by yourself to now playing with another drum set player?
Yeah, And Mickey, you know, Mickey's a bit shamanistic, man. He's really cool for me to play with. He's like providing energy and atmosphere and all this stuff. I mean, the guy's done more for drums and drumming than, I don't know, most people. You know, his collection's substantial. You know, he's put together some great projects.
Oh, yeah.
So it was the thing out of respect, like, hey, man, I want to go for this. Plus, Phil and I were really connecting. So it was a great thing. It was two drummers. It was totally cool. And Phil was happy. So I think Mickey was digging the fact like, hey, man, we're resonant here. We're feeling good about this thing. So Mickey and I got along really well. And I followed Mickey for the most part. You know, I put my thing on it and I was encouraged to do different things. But a lot of it was just, okay, I want whoever's singing to sound great. And, you know, that was pretty much my approach. Make the other guys really comfortable. So yeah. That's what it was like. But Mickey was really cool for sure.
Were you both playing bass drums in that group?
No, Mickey had a low end rig, but he was mostly doing his stand up thing, not stand up comedy, stand up drumming, where he had a big, cool rig. But most of the kick drum stuff was mine. Not all the time, but most of the time. As I recall, that was a while ago.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. You know, I saw a bunch of those shows. Also, if I remember on those shows, you did some Hornsby tunes too. Like Rainbow's Cadillac, I even think, might have been one of them. So when you're doing the Hornsby tunes, is the role changing and Mickey's following you a little bit more?
Yeah, exactly. Which Mickey was totally cool with, you know. It's a different feel. You know, Bruce and I, in a lot of ways, we were more in pursuit of New York jazz and R&B, you know. So I'm thinking like Elvin, even though I don't sound anything like him, I'm still conceptually thinking like, okay, we're going to make this thing kind of somewhere between like Not Fade Away and, you know, Coltrane and Elvin. So that's what we're going for. So when we do that with the Dead Guys, we just kind of bring them along a little bit without being draconian or Procrustean in nature, you know, forcing it, just letting it be and having them bring their thing to it.
But that makes so much sense for that music, especially, you know, when you think about Billy, he's a huge Elvin fan, you know, so you're coming in from the right mindset right from the get-go, because you're thinking, and the person you're thinking of is the same person who's a huge influence on Bill.
Yeah, Billy, yeah, man. I was talking to Hornsby the other day. Bruce and I still just randomly chat. And, you know, what starts out to be a 3-minute conversation goes for about 20. But he said the same thing. You know, I talked about Billy and he goes, yeah, man, he gets that Elvin thing going. So it's not just for the drummers. I mean, there are other people picking up on it. He gets that jazz tilt going.
Yeah. And, that left hand.
That way. Like I said, I can't impersonate him.
After Bruce, you guys get introduced to them in 87 when you open for him, but then Bruce, like you said, starts playing with them in 90 all the way through towards off and on towards the end. Does Bruce moving over and starting to play with the Dead change the approach that you and him are taking with his music?
Absolutely. We played Laguna Seca. I think you're thinking maybe that's our first show.
Right.
Rye Cooter's on that. And Jim Keltner's playing drums with Rye. And we get a cool slot. So we played the first day. And I mean, you got to think, we're a new band. We've got like 11 songs. So we play the first day and they're cool with it. And we play the second day. And Bruce and I recall this a little bit differently, but it's almost the same. We start the second day and we play a couple of the same songs that we played on the first day.
Deadheads hate that.
There's two guys up front. And as I recall, they were nice, and one of them said, hey, man, you're not going to play the same show. But Bruce remembers it as one of them yelling at him, not the same show. And we were like, oh, right, Deadheads. They were here yesterday. And Bruce immediately adjusted. So that was a bit of a turning point. Also, the looseness with the set list. You know, you have a few songs in mind, and then you just kind of wing it depending on the crowd. He was much looser in a lot of ways with his approach, and also changing the set every night. You got to remember, like when I played with John Fogerty, we basically played the same show every night.
Right. And it's all the same 3-minute songs.
Yeah. It's like a jukebox.
Right.
Really good jukebox.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, I said to them one time, I said, man, you know, to his brother, Bob, I said, Bob, you're not going to get people coming 2 or 3 nights in a row if you're playing the same show. You guys, Creedence and John, there's so much material to borrow from. So that's one of the things we learned from the Dead. Like if you want people to come more than one night, give them something special.
From a musical standpoint, did it lead to you change as a band? I'm talking about you and Bruce, and this is after the Range, but you're still with Bruce. Does it lead you guys to start jamming more and taking the music out a little further?
Yes.
For sure. Yeah. Right on.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I talked to Bruce and said, hey, man, are you in New York? And he goes, yeah. I said, oh, how is he? He goes, man, I had dinner with Ornette Coleman last night. You know, so his brain just really expanded from, you know, the pop side, Bruce Hornsby in the Range with the hits, to if you go listen now to where it's at, you know, his most recent outings, they're just wonderful. They're not pop records, but they are so artsy and just wonderful that, you know, he reached that place as an artist. I think a lot of it had to do with the Dead, for sure.
As you move on from that, you know, you do the other ones, and then that leads to Phil. That you're learning so much of a new repertoire right now. You know, you got so many new songs that you got to put into your catalog. How are you learning them? Are you listening to the Grateful Dead versions? Are they laying stuff on you to check out? How do you start to immerse yourself in the catalog as you start playing with them?
Well, you know, I was really lucky because musician-wise, Jimmy Herring, Warren Haynes, and then the Oracle, as we call them, I call them Rob Baracco, they all had a certain take on the material, and Rob knew it down. Jimmy is just so industrious and really studied the stuff. Warren has kind of the photographic memory. I knew probably 50 to 60% of it. But the way we learned it was as a unit, as I recall, and we started putting a bit of a different take on it. There were occasionally things like in Terrapin, Phil wanted me to play a certain way, and he would look at me and go, no, John, what I'm thinking. And then he would play air drums for me, which was just magical and comedic and confounding all at the same time. There's Phil, who I've never seen sit behind a drum kit, kind of air drumming, kind of tap dancing, Paul Moitian around the kit. And I'm like, okay, man, I'll do my best.
Sure, that explains everything. No problem, Phil.
I got it, man. So just to jump ahead a little bit, so we kind of developed our own things. So I'm working with Graham Lash one time, and I said, hey, Graham, how do you play this section? And like I said earlier, Pride of Cucamonga. And Graham goes, well, I don't know how the Dead did it. I learned it from the Cue with you and Warren and Jimmy and Rob. So his generation and some people like that was like, oh, yeah, Kimok and Trey, you know, Warren and Jimmy. Yeah, I like that. So we just kind of started to put our own stamp on it. Kimok, I, and Phil, Steve Kimmock and I drove through the, I don't know, we were way up in the mountains, man. We were listening to Coltrane and just really into it. So, excuse me, some collective listening occasionally helped as well.
I'm thinking, as you're mentioning all these names, you, obviously the Cue was probably the most well-known of the lineups that you were in, but you were with Phil for so long and Phil Lesh and friends. You played with so many different players in that group. I mean, your first shows were with Trey and Page, I'm pretty sure.
Correct.
Is it difficult as you're playing with Trey and Page for a while, then you got Kimmock, and then you got Schofield, and you got Jimmy and Warren. Does your playing in general have to change a lot, a little bit, according to the lineup you have? Not just the players, but the instrumentation as well.
You know, a little bit. you mentioned the guys from Phish, Trey and Page. I was a casual Phish fan. I like the void that they filled and the framework that they provided for the listeners. Thought they were a really good band, not really big on the songwriting thing, but I wasn't overly familiar with it. There's a couple in there. But overall, I just thought, you know, they're cool, man. They got a good band. But when I worked with Trey and Page, I realized they also have a serious work ethic. We rehearsed a lot and really put the time in. I didn't know how Trey and Kimmock were going to work out, but they did really well. And I don't know Page that well. but he was a nice guy and he was prepared. So it was really cool. And I realized they have a lot of serious fans, man. So I was glad to be part of that lineup. For me, credibility wise, you know, I still have people come up and go, oh yeah, you played with Trey and Kimmock. And I was like, yeah, you know, even getting back to Hornsby, Hornsby said he was just going to give it a casual listen, a couple of songs. He said he ended up listening to like 4 hours of it. So that was a great lineup. I do change my playing occasionally. I try to really follow the soloist and what's going on musically. But every once in a while, you got to drive the bus, too, as a listener or as a player. Every once in a while, I project myself into the audience as a listener and go, would you be digging this? And might try to change it up a little bit, but I try not to harness it or control it. I just try to let it go. And, you know, playing with Phil is great. You know, sometimes we are just so connected. It's unbelievable. Other times, not so much, but.
Well, it's going to be like that with anybody. I mean, you know, always good nights and bad nights, you know, can be because of a myriad of reasons. What you ate that night, how much you slept, what you guys talked about. There's so many different things that can play into it.
And I would say this, Rob, that they were all good nights. It was just some were really magical. Metric modulations going into the next song. All of a sudden we were at tempo and feel and the right key. I don't know how that happened. So the magical nights, but they were all pretty consistently good. I don't think I ever got like, I'm going to quit the band because we suck.
Right. Well, especially like that Q lineup, you know, that might've been, I can't say this for sure, but that's one of the longest running constant lineups that you guys had. And those jams just got super, super deep. You know, and the catalog expanded too, because you all got comfortable with each other. When you're doing that, you mentioned Phil talking about a part of Terrapin where he air drummed to show you what he would envision on that. But by and large, when you guys are in that setting, the queue, does he have a specific vision in there? Or are you guys just allowed to go without a net and do what you do?
Pretty much without a net, especially now. He just lets it rip. Occasionally, back in the early days, he'd have a box he would step on and go E or something. And Rob and Jimmy and Warren were like, we'll hear it. I said, man, even I can hear it. Come on, man. And eventually he let that kind of go. He just kind of was like, oh, these guys are going to follow this immediately. So that band also developed because it was easy. Everybody knew the material really well. The vocals were solid with Rob and Warren and Phil. You know, Warren is not totally unique in that, but rare in that he's a great lead singer, but he's an excellent harmony singer. So we had the vocals covered. And I think with the Dead, you know, a lot of times the audience knows the lyrics better than I do, you know, unless I can see one of the guy's teleprompters and then I just follow along.
Right.
Follow the bouncing ball, as we say. So the thing with the cue was, they had it down lyrically, and I think the connection with the audience was substantial because of that.
That's awesome. I mean, I saw a bunch of those shows, always enjoyed it. Just because you took those songs, that group would take those songs to places they hadn't really been in the Grateful Dead's.
Thank you so much.
This is anytime you're playing with somebody, like, let's just talk about this with Phil. His bass playing style, it's so non-traditional and it's different, you know, very, very different from how most rock players play. You know, the one almost doesn't exist. How does that affect you as a drummer? Do you have to have a different level of concentration, or do you have to approach the aesthetic of the groove differently because it's such a non-traditional way to play bass?
Non-traditional is a really nice way to say it, Rob. The first couple of times I played with him, I realized we're going into the chorus and you're playing from the lower register to the upper register without making a delineation between the verse or B section or pre-chorus into the chorus.
Right.
So I picked up on that pretty quick. I had a friend of mine who was not a Deadhead, but was a very good musician. And he came out to hear the cue. And afterwards he said, man, that was just great. He goes, but I got to tell you, man, that bass player ain't giving you much to go on. And I said, I dig it. I said, he developed that thing, you know, that's his thing of like not giving it away necessarily. Root fifth. Here's the chorus and bang, bang. It's a different approach, but I picked up on it quickly and it is non-traditional, but just like I said, Phil was given time and permission from himself as well as the band to develop that style. And it is peerless. But like I said, Bobby Hornsby really helped me with the Phil Lesh style of bass playing. He really had it down. So I was prepared a bit. And also, you know, just hearing Bruce's take and playing some of the songs, I sort of got the idea of what they were doing.
My answer to your buddy who said, what did you say? He's not giving you a lot to go with.
He actually was much more astute. He says he ain't giving you nothing.
My answer to that would be, he's giving me a lot, but he might not be giving me anything that my right foot, my bass drum would be working with, but he's giving me plenty to play with. It's just in a different way.
That is the right answer, Rob. And I think I sort of got to that after my initial kind of, I thought it was just funny. It was such a musoid, intellectual, kind of traditional way to look at it, but I'm with you. If he's got permission, I have permission to loosen it up make it feel special for the audience and for us.
It's not going to be your traditional, my kick drum is going to line up with your bass going into the chorus and coming out and all that. It's going to be, it's a different way to play, but there's still
something to be a different way to play it. So like I said, like with Scott LaFaro, you know, he was searching for a thing. You know, he found it. Unfortunately, he passed away early. Phil, on the other hand, I think he has 9 lives, man. Yeah. It's just like keeps going. And every time I hear him, I'm like, man, that guy just sounds great.
And he just had a birthday a couple of days ago, I think.
Yes. He puts that bass on, he he transcends time. And we've talked about that before, too, that when we're playing music, we don't age.
Right. So I want to ask one more thing about all this. When you're not with Phil, you go out and you work with Fogerty. You work with David Nelson. You work with Chris Robinson and Greenleaf Rustlers. You got Moon Alice, of course, California Kind, all these different groups. Where you go back to, I'm going to use that word, a more traditional form of the music and a more traditional groove, if you will, on a lot of that stuff, especially like Fogerty, like you were talking about. So when you get into those kind of other applications, you know, those other settings, does that ethos of the Grateful Dead and the jamming and the influence still permeate your playing when you go into all these other settings?
Okay. I'll touch on that real quickly. Not with John Fogerty. He doesn't like the Dead that much. He's okay with the songs, but he is not like, anytime I try to jam or open it up, the door would shut. But having said that, I love those songs. Down in the Corner, Proud Mary, Bad Moon Rising, Green River, Born on the Bayou. You can't beat it, man. It is just wonderful. And I had a great relationship with John, and it's cool, but that's show drumming. That's really hard volume. There's SVTs and Marshalls up there. You got to unleash, you know, like if you watch Kenny Aronoff,
right?
He's very strong, man. He's pounding it. You mentioned Chris Robinson, one of my favorite singers. And, you know, with Chris, you can bring a little bit of that in there. You know, he's so well-rounded, but you got to kick ass. You know, you got to give him something to really dig into, because he's got an interesting hybrid of styles. You know, he's a wonderful singer, and I can bring a little bit in on that. With young Katie, she's kind of like Bonnie Raitt meets the Dead. I think she's at her best when she's playing blues electric guitar with that slide and playing really cool classic kind of Dylan, Dead, Neil Young, Clapton. So with her, yeah, you take it out a little bit, and she'll even get a little psychedelic. You know, she'll lose form, and you know, I think it just depends on who the artist is and where you take it and how you bring that Dead influence into it.
I read a quote. I meant to ask you this earlier. I had it on a piece of paper over here. I read a quote from you in some article you must have done years ago, whenever, I don't know. I just saw it and I wrote it down because it meant just think about the music and you'll sound good. Do you remember saying that?
That sounds like something I might have been working on at the time. Like, don't let the distractions get to you. Would you say that quote one more time?
Just think about the music and you'll sound good.
Yeah. All your other stuff, put it away. Like, not to be a pot advocate, but one of the reasons I liked smoking pot back in the late 70s is because I couldn't multitask. All I could do is think about the music to get through. Couldn't space out. Couldn't think about the lights or the sound. Just think about the music, man. and the feel, not the feelingness of, or the feelings, but the feel of the music, what it's trying to convey, you know, be it a Bob Dylan song or a Neil Young song, you know, some of them rock, some of them don't, you know, you just get into it as much as you can without the distractions, and don't mix your monitors while you're playing, you know, Positively 4th Street or whatever.
Right.
Play the song.
Just find in your heart what works for the tune.
Yeah. And do your best. And, you know, some people say, well, follow your dreams. Don't let anything get in the way. Yeah, follow your dreams if you've got the skills, but don't be delusional. You know, my daughter is one of the best listeners of music I've ever been around. She can play a little bit, but what a great listener, man. She gets it. So music is, you know, you never know what you're going to do. You could end up being a music editor or music attorney or a drummer. There's a lot of professions involved with music.
Oh, shit. You could be stuck at home while you can't play drums and you start a podcast. You just never know.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's a great idea to talk about some of this music. And you know so many of the cool players in the scene. And there's a bunch of them, man. You know,
it is. It's been a lot of fun doing this and getting, you know, to talk to my friends, but more, which is great. You know, we don't get to talk that often. But more just to be able to get this out there for some people to really hear some of these people who they go out and watch all the time and hear where their mindset is and where they're coming from. And, I thank you for sharing yours with us. Before I let you go though, if you don't mind, I have in my podcast, I end every one of these interviews with the world's slowest lightning round. I try to make it a lightning round and it never goes that way. So we'll see how we do.
Okay. Well, that's the speed of light, lightning. I might be at the speed of sound.
Okay. Are you ready?
Sure, man. I'm nervous.
No, you'll be fine. You already answered the first one. First show was American University.
Correct.
Favorite show?
William and Mary, 1979.
Studio recordings or live recordings?
Both. I like the production values from Terrapin Station that Keith Olsen produced.
Yeah. Favorite Dead album? It's going to get worse. Wait till the next one.
You know, I can't even think of the titles. What's right, the one that begins with A and it's hard to pronounce?
Yeah, that one. I won't try, but
Moxorixin. That was like a prescription drug. Right. There's that one. And then there's the one where they kind of sound like Uncle John's band.
That's remember that. Working Pardon? Man's Dead.
Yeah.
American Beauty. No, Working Man's Dead.
There's so many of them. I mean, you know, and also I didn't listen to the albums as much as I did like 100 songs at one time. Right. No excuses, though.
Oh, you're going to hate this question.
Okay, so favorite album, though, you were asking?
Yeah, favorite album.
Terrapin.
All right, here we go. Favorite non-Dead album. Nobody likes this question. It's too hard.
No, I like it. I just have so many that I like. That's the hard thing.
That's right.
Buddy Rich, Mercy Mercy.
Favorite color?
Purple.
Me too. A lot of drummers say purple. First job?
Delivering newspapers in Washington, D.C. for a newspaper called The Evening Star.
Favorite venue to play?
Second banana to the Washington Post.
Right on. Favorite venue to play?
Red Rocks.
Best city for a day off?
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. Because it's close to home or just because there's so much to do?
Well, the Smithsonian's there.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of great restaurants, and it's a little easier to get around than New York or some of the other cities. But my favorite day off, Niagara Falls with Moon Alice and the Tea Sisters. Nice. That was really fun. Beautiful weather, funny photos, and they have great energy.
First car, you remember?
1972 Oldsmobile Cutlass convertible.
Current car?
Black. I got to make sure I say this right. Black Chevy Tahoe.
Yeah, sounded right to me.
Black Tahoe.
Book you're reading right now.
Interestingly enough, yes. The Scott LaFaro biography. I think it's called Shades of Jade or something like that, where he talks about, I didn't realize what a West Coaster he was. He grew up in the Valley, or later in Canoga Park. And, you know, he talks about playing with Bill Evans and just a lot of cool stuff. So that's, I got to finish it. I'm taking my time.
Right on. Any magazine subscriptions?
No.
All right. And the last one, the first trip you will take when this madness is over.
Upstate Michigan, up around Traverse City.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, man. Go out on one of the lakes there and do some boarding.
Well, hey, man, I can't thank you enough for taking time today. I always love talking with you. This was a great one. So I appreciate you putting it out there for everybody, man.
Oh, yeah. And much love to, you know, all the people that have seen me over the years. I'm not always great with the recognition factor, but I do have to say I was playing the Capitol Theater about a couple of years ago with Phil, and I saw some people in the lobby of the courtyard by Marriott. And I said, oh, hey, how you doing? I was on stage. I recognized them from the audience. I said, oh, I was right by you guys. So you guys were like in the fifth row. And they said, yeah, where were you sitting? And I said, behind the drums. So a little comedy and a little humility, right?
That happens to us a lot, those guys who sit in the back, you know?
Yeah. Well, like I say, well, we're out here in Jamaica with my favorite three Robs. Right. Rob Quartz, Rob Baracco, and Rob the guitarist.
Yeah. All right, Molo, thank you so much, my friend. I really appreciate it. That's John Molo for you, everybody.
Thank you so much, Rob.
All right, take care.
Take care. Peace out, bro.
So much fun. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode, and I'd like to thank John Molo and Shuhei over in Tokyo for spending some time with me today. I'd also like to thank my sponsors, Sarno Music Solutions and Blue Jade Audio, The Clean Store, The Authenticity Academy, and Grateful Sweats, who is giving $10 off every purchase now through April 7th with the coupon code THEMUSICPLAYS. If you enjoyed the show today and would like to support the cause, please consider a subscription at www.patreon.com/THEMUSICPLAYS that offers weekly bonus content, or make a one-time contribution at paypal.me/THEMUSICPLAYS. Any love is much appreciated as we get this show off the ground. The Music Plays the Band is produced by myself and the production and songwriting team Brothers Lazaroff here in St. Louis, Missouri. You can find out more about them at www.brotherslazaroff.com. The opening and segue music you are hearing are remixes of portions of DSO drum segments that are produced by my drumming partner Dino English. I'll be back again in 2 weeks on April 8th with episode 10. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and please stay vigilant. We are starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel, folks, and it's going to take everybody's efforts to get us there as quickly as possible, and we appreciate that. So we'll see you again soon, and thanks for being here.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.